Hello and welcome to the fifth Music Business Worldwide podcast, supported by CI, experts in digital music delivery, working with some of the biggest independent labels, distributors and aggregators in the world. Our guest today is the founder of one of the most exciting young music publishing companies on the planet. Downtown Music Publishing began in 2007, born in New York City, with a mission to reimagine music publishing. Its client base now ranges from the estate of John Lennon through to Ray Davies, Randy Newman, Hans Zimmer and One Direction, while some of its writers have penned tracks for the likes of Beyoncé, Kanye West, Katy Perry and Rihanna. Downtown is notable not only for the way that it has embraced the digital era, but also because it's such a fast-growing company, and earlier this year acquired Eagle Eye, the British independent publisher, which it's used as a launchpad to enter the UK market. The founder of Downtown Music Publishing, Justin Kalifowitz, joins the MBW podcast today to discuss a range of issues, not only affecting music publishers, but songwriters and the wider music ecosystem. Justin, welcome to the MBW podcast.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here.
So Downtown Music Publishing is supposedly reimagining music publishing. What opportunity did you see in 2007 when you set the business up, and how have you taken advantage of that opportunity since then?
When we first got going back in 2007, we kind of looked at this as in the music publishing business broadly and saw how much consolidation had gone on. I remember my first conversations about the business began around how many independent publishers had existed just a few years before and how many major publishers had been consolidated. It was right after Universal bought the first BMG a few years prior. And we couldn't really believe at how many great songwriters were out there who were working at companies that they hadn't actually signed to. And we kind of looked at the opportunity and said, you know, this is something that we can change. The relationship between a songwriter and a publisher shouldn't be thought of as merely a banking relationship, which is really the tenor that the lawyers and managers and many people started to talk about. I kept hearing it over and over again that the relationship with the publisher had become really more of a banking relationship as opposed to a dynamic creative relationship. And sort of secondarily, we didn't really think that the industry had sort of looked at publishing through the lens of technology, you know, whether or not it's copyright management or licensing, how they handle royalty collection, even how they engage with their clients wasn't really thought of through a lens of technology. I mean, much of the way in which I often say much of the way in which the music publishing industry operates is still kind of the same way when everyone was hoping that Frank Sinatra would cut their songs. They haven't really kind of brought technology to the table. And over the past, almost going on 9 years, that we've been in business, we've seen even more consolidation. I could not imagine when I started that this many great music publishers would have been sold. The sheer ratio of the number of executives to the number of active writers is completely off kilter. The people are fantastic. You know, many of my best friends work at major publishers and larger businesses, and they're great individuals. But, you know, you often hear the refrain like, you know, we just bought so-and-so and my roster's doubled in size.
You have company offices in Los Angeles, Nashville, Amsterdam and London, which we'll come on to shortly. But the hub of Downtown, where it was born, is New York. We recently met up in Downtown's hometown and you told me you were feeling, and I hope this is roughly verbatim, incredibly bullish about the future of the music publishing industry. Now, lots of people in that world occasionally feel a bit downtrodden, a little pessimistic about what might be happening to particularly songwriters in the streaming age.
I'm very bullish. You did say it verbatim. You know, the truth of the matter is that, you know, I think oftentimes, and for 15 years, you've seen the record industry in decline. And, you know, it's flatlined over the past few years, stabilizing. And the press, particularly sort of the mainstream press and business press, will conflate the sort of decline of the recorded music business and the ills of the recorded music business with the broader music industry. And I think similar to the live industry, the publishing industry has been bright and exciting. We've had years of flat. We've had years of decline. But for the most part, over the past 15 years, it's been pretty good. And it's been led by the fact that people often forget that publishing is mostly driven by how businesses utilize music and not how people consume music. We're less exposed to that. We're less exposed to shifts in consumption by any individual. The other thing that I talk about and I think about it a lot is that when you look at the world, whether or not legally, illegally, recorded music has been consumed all over the planet and been paid for all over the planet. That hasn't really been the case in music publishing. I mean, music publishing as an industry is evolved in Western Europe. It's evolved in North America. It's evolved in Japan, Australia, New Zealand. Much of the rest of the world is only just starting to pick up on music publishing through efficient collection society mechanisms and not to mention laws. So, you know, I think that when you think about the fact that less than 1/6 or 1/7 of the world's population currently lives in places where, you know, music publishing as an industry is mature, that's a very exciting proposition. I think over time, we're going to start to see a number of markets come online that are exciting.
Yeah, and that international collection side of things is obviously exciting in the digital age. But to go back to the idea of streaming services and the proportion of payouts that is currently finding its way into publishers' pockets and their songwriters' pockets, I realise this is something of a controversial topic, and it gets pretty complex, especially over your side of the pond. But are you optimistic for how much share of streaming revenues ultimately going to end up with the publishing side of the business in the future?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the first comment to make is that, well, it can't get any worse. but you know, in all seriousness, you know, when you look at those rates and you look at kind of how we're paid, you know, so much of the music publishing market in the United States is regulated, you know. But you have situations where it's a horrible split at Pandora, 4% right now for non-interactive streaming coming to publishers. And, you know, even sort of the mechanicals from CDs and downloads are, you know, subject to regulation, Spotify streaming subject to regulation. And what you see happening in the free markets is something that's quite different. For example, on YouTube, the private market negotiations between music publishers and YouTube resulted in, 15% to publishers and 35% to labels, and 50 to YouTube. So it was a better ratio there, right? Basically 33 to 66 between labels and publishers. And then what you see happening in traditional sync licensing is straight up 50-50. In fact, there's a lot of times as a publisher where I know we're getting a much higher fee on the publishing side than the master. And, you know, the examples always given is when an emerging artist is doing a very well-known song copyright, the advertising agency or the film studio is often not willing to pay the same amount for the new master by this emerging artist as they are for this very well-established song copyright. I think it's a function of the fact that you can't copy the song copyright, but you can certainly have another artist consider recording a new master of that. So by definition, the song copyright is almost more exclusive. I think over time, I just can't see the regulation continuing to be as heavy-handed, especially when you look at some of those recent statistics that came out that I believe you published on Music Business Worldwide, showing that publishers and record companies, at least with respect to the A&R in the UK, are spending roughly the same amount. I mean, all of those old regulated rates were a function of the former business model where the record industry would spend considerable sums that were in excess of publishing in the development of new songwriters and artists, and, you know, spend tremendous sums in other areas, where it's just simply not the case anymore.
It's interesting to hear you talk about freer markets. I take it you're referring to those territories, Europe being an obvious one, where publishers can directly negotiate their rates with digital services. And that presumably leads to more generous splits for publishers on services such as YouTube.
I mean, quite simply, whenever the government's not involved, publishers get a much higher percentage of the overall pie. So, you know, overall, and at least in the United States, government doesn't really want to regulate industries that they don't feel like they have to. So I believe that, you know, this is really a function of how music used to be distributed and consumed and sold. And I think that a lot of this will change over time as more of this information about how the free market dictates rates is trickled down to all of the folks in government. we're going to be able to see a scenario where hopefully that will lead to either less regulation. So you see what's happening with a Department of Justice right now, taking into consideration whether or not ASCAP or BMI still need to operate under the consent decree, or, you know, hopefully moving things into more of a free market negotiation. So as some of these services look to do things with music that falls outside of, you know, just a non-interactive streaming, right, or outside of an interactive, right, the way that Apple did, which Apple was able to do a free market negotiation, which resulted in slightly higher rates for publishers. We're starting to see a move in that direction. And I think more broadly than talking about the percentage of revenue that's coming from any one streaming service is the mere fact that I think streaming services, I think we all, everyone in the music business is probably operating on this basis, that streaming services themselves are in their infancy and their valuations are through the roof as a function of expected future growth, not what they're currently doing today. Yeah. I also think that when you think about the music publishing business, you have a situation where the revenue that a songwriter is seeing on their royalty statement from ASCAP is not 100% of the streaming revenue they're entitled to. And there's a lot of misunderstanding there. There's also quite a, you know, because their publisher is collecting the lion's share, at least in the United States, of their streaming revenue and then passing it on to them based on what their contract says. There's also, you know, wild inconsistencies with reporting between each of the streaming services, when they report, how they report, how they distribute the income, what level of information is available to their to the agents they utilize to actually distribute the songs properly. There's reportedly considerable income that's in suspense right now that the industry as a whole is trying to figure out how to unlock to better pay songwriters and publishers.
So this is the lost revenue we've been hearing about, with various reasons and excuses for it, but ultimately that streaming services are struggling to match data with every single songwriter, every single publisher out there.
Yeah, and what they're faced with an incredible challenge, right? Because the record companies on a weekly basis upload, you know, thousands and thousands of new copyrights, new sound recordings that utilize underlying song copyrights without including the metadata about who the songwriter and publisher are. I mean, the amount of uncleared music that goes online is insane, even for big hits. And obviously it's quite easy for them to go through the top 100 and work out, you know, who the songwriters and publishers are. But we're talking about databases with 18 million plus songs and, you know, consumption patterns that suggest that most people are listening to catalog. And if it wasn't updated right the first time, how, you know, it gets sort of deprioritized. So these are huge, significant challenges for the industry to focus on, not only the publishers themselves and dealing with the streaming services, but also bringing in the record companies as partners and saying, you know, listen, you're off the hook. You don't have to pay the mechanical that's paid by the streaming service, but you gotta come to the table. And if you're going to use our copyrights, at least distribute your sound recordings with the correct metadata.
So how does this problem get solved? Is the onus on the streaming service to improve the connection between the metadata and the songwriter and publisher information?
I think it's going to require all hands on deck for you know, both publishers, the streaming services, and the record companies to come to a situation they're happy with. I mean, Spotify, my guess, is not pleased with songwriters and artists complaining about the low level of payment. And you can debate all day, is 10.5% in the United States enough for songwriters? But, you know, it's sort of inexcusable that it's assumed that less than 75 to 80% of that is actually making its way to songwriters and publishers because of data issues. We need to solve for that first, and I think then also look to increase the rate that goes to songwriters.
You mentioned the 4% Pandora figure before. Just to explain if I've got that correctly, that's 4% of Pandora's annual revenues, which this year look like they're going to top $1 billion. 4% end up with ASCAP and BMI and then passed on to their publisher members each year. Pandora has been such a bugbear for music publishers the world over, but particularly in the US. As we see the service do new deals with the likes of Sony ATV, just the direct deal we saw the other week, that look as though it's moving towards becoming more of an interactive streaming service as we see it expand into new areas with purchase of Ticketfly recently, taking a chunk out of the live industry. Do you feel more optimistic about what Pandora is going to contribute to the music publishing sector in the future?
Well, I'm a diehard RDO user, so God willing, Pandora changes and embraces all of the beauty of RDO's platform, which I think has, you know, from a design and usability perspective, was the clear leader. So I'm very hopeful from a personal perspective that Pandora does change. I think from a business standpoint, I believe they have to. The non-interactive streaming as a strategy wasn't really working out too well. They saw their user numbers declining recently. Obviously, Wall Street wasn't happy. I think their ability to grow outside of the United States was extraordinarily limited by trying to just do this non-interactive license, which I understand was a non-starter in the UK and other markets. So when you have a situation like that and you see the moves they're making, whether it's the sort of a deal with Sony, which, you know, I'm interested to see what that looks like, or the notion that they're acquiring a business like RDO, which is a fantastic interactive streaming platform, will hopefully enable them to expand their product offering. The exciting thing is that they have, you know, close to 80 million people in the United States alone, using them to consume music, right? So if we can offer them a broader range of services, not just non-interactive streaming, but also streaming, think about what could be if they could convert that base, right? And think about what that could mean if they can convert more of those free users to paying users, and paying out at a higher rate. That could be a real windfall for the industry. And I'm supportive and bullish of anyone who is investing money in getting consumers to opt for paid services over free services. I think that's really the holy grail for our businesses, getting more people on paid platforms and stop giving away our music for free.
I mean, that's a huge industry hot potato this year. The idea of free or ad-supported music and quite how much revenue is coming from those platforms to the industry. If we forget freemium for a second and just talk about free ad-supported services, I mean, are you optimistic that the music industry can put the squeeze on those platforms enough to eke out some more value in the coming years?
I only have one thing to say. Can you get the Adele album for free right now? No. you can't. And people are going through extraordinary pains to try to find it for free. And they are going out and doing something incredible, which is buying it, right? And our industry likes to think that, you know, people are just getting stuff for free on the internet, and Adele's done a nice job reminding us that that's not necessarily the case. People do pay for music. I just don't necessarily know that everyone understands the $10 a month unlimited is not something that necessarily resonates with everyone. And I think ultimately the issue that we have is that for so many people, their music service is their Google search bar. They type in the name of any song they want to hear, and the first 5, 6, 7, 8 links are links to videos. There are links to SoundCloud. The artists signed to major labels putting up their music for free on SoundCloud. You know, if you're a kid with just hardly any disposable income, and, you know, are you really going to pay for a streaming service when with just a little bit, I mean, slightly more device, I mean, it's probably easier to find music, you know, through your Google search bar than it is on a streaming service. As an industry, as long as we continue to do that, I think we're going to really be shooting ourselves in the foot in terms of being able to grow the paid streaming side. And I do believe there's a place for free. I just don't believe it should be as widely adopted as it is today.
A dangerous question on a topic that's been at the forefront of a lot of discussion about music publishing in the digital age. Do you have an issue with the cost to income ratio, the commission that's being taken by collection societies, be that performing or mechanical, around the world? And then I guess, you know, you have to turn around to your writers and explain where X percent of their income has gone.
Yeah, you know, I mean, one of the things that we've been fortunate to be able to do is really reduce the cost of collection for our clients around the world by establishing direct relationships with over 40 different collection societies around the world, which, you know, definitely not only reduces the cost of collection to them, but also speeds up payments. But, you know, then you have to turn around and explain to them that certain collection societies only distribute certain revenue streams once a year. In 2015, that's wholly unacceptable. Certain collection societies charge a variety of rates that when added up can exceed almost 35%. In 2015, that's highly unacceptable for processing data. You know, that I don't believe that those rates will continue for long. I think what we're seeing through pan-European licensing is, you know, a capping of those rates at, you know, half to a third of what the societies are typically charged. There are other private market entrants that are considering how to attack this issue. And I think, you know, rights owners and songwriters and creators, it's untenable in this day and age to charge those kinds of fees to process data. No other industry would stand for it.
I mentioned earlier that I wanted to talk about your London office, which has probably been the biggest news for Downtown this year. You announced the acquisition of Eagle Eye, run by Roberto Neri, a popular and respected executive on these shores. What's your plan on the UK side of things? Why did you need a base in London? And why did you pick Eagle Eye?
You know, again, I think when we started the business, we wouldn't have thought that we could open Downtown in the UK. There were so many great independent publishers out there, you know, operating long histories of doing incredible work. But again, look at the consolidation that's happened in the UK. Some of my favorite companies and publishers, you know, now working in other businesses, having been acquired and consolidated. So it created this market opportunity. Secondarily, I mean, just look at the UK and how it punches so far above its weight class. You know, you sign songwriters and artists out of the UK and they perform extraordinarily well all over the world, you know, well outside of, you know, where the UK sits as a market. It's unbelievable. Some of my favorite music personally is from the UK. And when I think about what we were looking to do there, we had Tom Graham working for us in A&R. For a short while, and we were doing, you know, some amazing work signing bands like Slaves and artists like Alani and starting to represent some incredible songwriters and producers. And we started to look around and thinking about building an office from scratch and the opportunity to acquire a business like Eagle Eye with a fantastic catalog, a great managing director who's built a great team, not only in traditional music publishing, but also in neighboring rights and in production music. We saw it as a perfect complement to what we were already doing. And it wasn't about bolting on a catalog and letting go all the staff that everyone liked. It was about a great catalog and a great team that we're going to continue to build off of. And as a function of that, we're going to actually be basing quite a bit of our operations there, including our global heads of finance and legal are going to be based in the UK, and we're going to continue to, you know, use it as a hub, not only for continuing to offer expanded services to songwriters from the UK and our songwriters from other offices that are in the Downtown network, but use it as a hub for further global expansion.
Let's talk specifically about Downtown and what your game plan is. Where do you see the company going within and beyond the music publishing world?
The ambition is clear, which is to offer a global rights management business that operates not only at the top level on the creative side, but also on the technology side, and really melds those two worlds together and is ready for any and all of the changes that are to come, but also gets to continue, most importantly, working with some of the most inspiring songs and songwriters in the world.
Justin Kalifowitz, thank you so much for coming on the MBW podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That just leaves me to say thank you once again to our supporter, CI. There'll be another MBW podcast towards the end of December with UK A&R legend Corder Marshall, now at BMG. We'll see you then.